Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the first day of February 2024. That's right, January's gone. Did you miss it? Did you see it? Did you blink? There it goes. As goes January, says the old adage, so goes the year on Wall Street and for stocks. And they were higher even after yesterday, even after the little pullback, even after the little temper tantrum that the market didn't get what the market wanted from Jay Powell. We've done this over and over again, folks. Jay Powell and the Fed say, here's what we're going to do. The markets start a narrative about 3 weeks ahead of time about starting to say, oh, they're not really going to do that. They're really going to be more dovish. They're really going to be easier. They're really going to ease more times. They're going to do just what we want. And then the Fed comes out and says, actually, we're going to do exactly what the hell we've been telling you we were going to do for the last 3 or 4 weeks while you all have been running your mouths. And we, in the stock market, throw a tantrum and share prices go down. To wit, Jay Powell said, I don't think it's likely that the committee will reach a level of confidence by the time of the March meeting to identify March as the time to cut. But that's to be seen. He said that over and over. I don't think March is going to be the time. And the markets didn't like it. So when the markets don't like it, all the stocks pull back. Fast forward 12 hours after the close, and all of a sudden, you see the 10-year Treasury rallying to a yield of 3.95. Now, folks, this really is a bit odd. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me that you'd see it rally just when the Fed said, we're not going to cut rates, we're going to keep them high. And so what do yields do? They go down. Jim Urio is a partner and lifelong trader, investor at TJM Institutional Services on the floor of the exchange, the voice of the exchange as far as I'm concerned, and my great friend. Welcome back, Jim, to the Farcast.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay, Jim, you heard me. Make any sense to you?
Yeah. Okay, so here's the way I can make sense of it, is that if the market believes that the Fed is dragging its feet on eases, much the same way they dragged their feet on tightening back in the late summer of 2021, then it would stand to reason that rates further out the curve would go down a bit, meaning that once they realize their mistake, I'm doing mistake in quotation marks in case it's might not be a mistake, but that's what the market believes. Now, and to your point, what you just said, which is we are so conditioned to think that the market, particularly the bond market, is the smart money, but the bond market has been catastrophically wrong on these eases for about a year. Now, yep. I do think there's a 50-50 shot at a March ease. And I will point this out. I went out the bank issue yesterday with first, what's that bank called? New York Community Bank, who had bought Signature Bank, and they posted awful earnings. And I think there is a deep, persistent worry that there's a problem in banks, particularly mid-level banks, and particularly related to commercial real estate. And that's what could force the Fed's hand. I've always thought, and I've said this to you, I think the stock market needs a quick 8 to 10% pullback in order to force the Fed's hand. And I still think there's a potential of that. Now, that being said, I don't want anyone to misconstrue and think I'm a stock bear, because we've talked about blueprints before. And I have a blueprint for this stock market too. It is still in an uptrend. And until we can settle the S&P futures below, let's call it 4790, which is about 100 ticks to the downside from here, I still think we're in an uptrend, if that makes sense to you.
Yes and no. I mean, sure. Does it make sense that yields go lower if we've got a black swan event coming up, which would be a revisiting, I think, of a banking crisis at these mid-level banks, that it's not healed, that it's not cured, that you see a fast flight of assets over the apps and everything else. We did that a year ago, ladies and gentlemen. You remember Silicon Valley Bank shares, and you remember sort of the crisis that it was. And we've smoothed over it, though structurally, they haven't solved much. Structurally, they haven't solved much. I think that the banks have been much more conservative in their reserves in meeting their liquidity requirements, in not making loans. I mean, that was actually a problem that was kind of slowing growth, but slowing the growth, maybe that slowed the inflation a little bit. GDP was ahead of where we thought. Inflation is lower than where we thought. I'm among many, which gives me no comfort, by the way, to be among many who were wrong. I expected a recession right about now. Really did. Why, Farr? Is that because you're so gloomy? No, I'm not gloomy. I've never been gloomy. I am a perpetual optimist. I will find this silver lining in the darkest cloud every time. I always think things are going to work out, and I'm a long-term investor. So why? Because that's what all the data lined up and told me. I've done this year after year after year for decades, and when all of the data leaned on one side of the ship is going to tip, folks. And there are times when it doesn't. And, you know, in another couple of years, maybe we'll understand why. But you bet on the data, the consistency of data, and you don't go with your hunches. So when I'm telling you I thought we'd be in recession by now, that's not a hunch. That's based on the data. So I'm going to differ with my friend Jim Urio here, and I'm going to stick with the Fed. Now, as I told you before, folks, I know Jay Powell, and I've heard him very recently say very directly, look, we are not declaring victory yet. We're happy. We like the trend, but we're not saying it's over. These were some in a private conversation. This is what he said. Very unguarded, but very serious. He's happy where we are, but he's not saying it's over yet. So I'm going to take him at his word. Now, Urio is seeing something else. Urio is saying there's something that can still big time blow up and go wrong. And that's not a feeling either, because he saw data yesterday that we all saw. He's making an extrapolation that could be entirely correct. I'm not willing to go there yet, but you give me a couple of weeks and I could be on Urio's team fast. Jim, what do we do? What do we do for opportunities in terms of investing or trading when the market's still near all-time highs? I mean, we've had about a 4 or 5% pullback off of these top highs and a bunch of stocks and tech seem to be pulling back. Tech futures are up again this morning. So that little problem yesterday seems to be over with. What's going on?
So we've talked about this on this show before. There's something in the trading world, the trading medium term and the long-term investing world, an axiom that always holds true is the notion that bulls can make money, bears can make money, pigs can get slaughtered. And the reason I bring this up is that when we've had a year like we had in 2023, we talk about this, what I do, you must rebalance to your risk tolerance. And particularly in, you know, tax deferred accounts where you don't have to pay capital gains tax. I have too many of the Magnificent Seven. I noticed that a few days ago before this happened, which, by the way, these are in my long-term accounts that I do not trade, but I looked at the holdings I have of those, which started out small many, many years ago, and now I'm uncomfortable with them, and I put some hedges on for those. I think that is prudent, probably not at the end of the year. It's probably better to pick an arbitrary date throughout the year. But then if you started out the year and you wanted to have 60% of your money in stocks and 40% in bonds, and all of a sudden the stocks went through the roof and it's 70%, it is prudent to rebalance. To your point about where is the recession gone, there's no question we're conditioned to think if rates go higher, the aggregate demand is supposed to pull back. It didn't this time. Why? Well, there's probably three reasons. The rapidity of the rate hikes locked up supply in some areas, particularly in houses. Now, the second thing is that the labor market, after coming about labor shortages for 2.5 years, I think companies were reluctant to shed. I think they're less reluctant now. But three, the most important thing, and you mentioned that 3.3% GDP, government spending is through the roof. So if that's going to continue, it brings on a whole host of other problems as well. And I do think 2024, some things to come to fruition. By the way, if the government's spending too much, what we'll see that in is they'll start to go further out the duration curve to auction bonds, and the reception for those bonds won't be as good. We've seen hints of that over the last 2 months. That'll be my clue as things break up. And I'm not cataclysmic. We're going to run the ship into the rocks and it's all going to fall apart. I just think there could be some stormy waters ahead that we will get through. I'm an eternal optimist too. Just people, I mean, you're more of an eternal optimist than I am without question, but I'm somewhat of an optimist who sounds like a pessimist.
I love that. I'm an optimist who sounds like a pessimist. I do that at times. You know, one of the things I recently, actually last night, I talked with the former U.S. ambassador to China about what's going on in China. And he was saying, look, these numbers that they're espousing are just ridiculous. This idea that they've got 5.5% growth in China is absurd, maybe 1.5%. Unemployment among the youth is through the roof. And now it is a criminal event in China to publish negative economic information. So if you're going to publish or broadcast negative information about the economy, if you're not going to sing from the songbook, you're going to jail. You're going to jail. So China has serious issues right now because Xi Jinping has prioritized his political ideal over his economic reality. This is fatal for any society, economy, country, folks. Fatal, fatal. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. I hope he sticks with it a whole hell of a lot longer, and China won't be a big worry for us. By the way, we were also noticing recently, we did apparently a flyby of one of their ships, a aircraft carrier. They're only one, actually. And as they would should have done as we did a flyby, they launched fighter jets. They launched them all from land, none from the aircraft carrier. Their military, they can't do it. Their military is really in some trouble now. So can they do some stuff with Taiwan? Yeah, probably, but their military readiness is anything but. So, you know, economically, Jim, when you and I look at the world and think about these things, U.S. is still in relatively much better shape. And China is the second largest economy in the world, long seen the world's growth engine years ago. And now without Hong Kong and without Jack Ma, with the war on their own economy, I think they're unreliable, and I don't think that they're going to be any kind of economically, I don't think we can look into them for any kind of support.
Tell me your
thoughts on China.
Okay, so no doubt about it. And last week when they decided to buy their own stock market, that's the throw in the towel of the failed policy. Their debt has gone up 85% in the last 8 years. Their currency's in the tank. The problem is low workforce and the rest of the world losing confidence in the notion that you can bully an economy through communism. And frankly, like you said, if they start to decline, it will be painful at first because they're a large part of our economy. But getting through that and past it and moving supply chains to places that are better suited and have laws that we better understand is a wonderful thing. But it might take a little bit of time. The fact that copper, by the way, has held up through all this China stuff, makes me think that copper is a place to be. Because if China actually ever does right its ship or at least stabilizes, I think that could blow up because the conductivity in the green energy movement as well. We got to go now?
Jim Murio is a partner at TJM Institutional Services, one of the brightest guys you're going to talk to on the street, folks. If you're a trader out there, you got to listen to Murio. He just has been doing it too long, and he knows too much. When he's not thinking about it, he knows more than the average guy walking down the street by 10. Thank you, Jim. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, Matt Leffingwell, Washington, D.C.'s one of Washington, D.C.'s great lobbyists, followed by Daryl Owen in segment three. We're going to figure out not only what's going on in Washington, the debates on Capitol Hill. Are they going to get funding? And then Daryl, a real expert on oil, but was chief of staff for Louisiana Senator Bennett Johnson for many years, has had his own firm. Lots of great stuff coming up on the Farcast. Please stay with us. To wit, the Fed statement says wages. That's the wrong quotation.
Don't cut this out. Leave it in. It's good stuff. People like real.
Three. Oh, geez. Three, two, one.
We're glad you could join us this week on the Farcast. Now back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. Thanks so much for being with us. It is the first day of February. First day of February. Here we go, folks. You know what that means? It means lots of wonderful things as we're progressing through the winter here, but Groundhog's Day, there's the bright light. I'm getting my greeting cards together right now. Groundhog's Day is an important day for markets and investors and people in Washington, D.C., who all have that wonderful knack of doing the same damn stupid thing over and over and over again, largely in the same damn ways. There you go. Well, one guy who always doesn't do things the same damn way and thinks outside of the box and creatively and has a lot of insights for us every time he appears is Matt Leffingwell, partner from the Tiber Group, which is a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C., an insider's insider in D.C. Welcome back, Matt.
Michael, it's great to be with you this morning. How you doing?
I am great. Thank you very much. Just great. And, you know, I'm kind of excited to see a bill actually pass in the House of Representatives. So we've got a big bill that just came through. Tell me, what's in this new sort of tax credit spending bill? And is there anything in there for the border wall? Anything in there for funding for Ukraine or Israel or any of that stuff? What got passed? No, none of it.
None of it. I mean, look, this was a piece of legislation. It was the brainchild of an outgoing chairman, the youngest chairman, Ways and Means chairman in 150 years, Jason Smith from Missouri. This is primarily a research and development tax credit legislation. The way they were able to make it bipartisan was a massive expansion of the child tax credit, which got all the Democrats on board. So the issue now is they passed the House by 357-70 late last night. It's already stalled in the Senate. There are a number of senators, including Senate Finance Chairman Mike Crapo, who does not like the idea of expanding the child tax credit and sending checks out to parents right before the November elections. The claim is that it will give Biden a boost with checks right before, you know, November.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I mean,
it makes perfect sense. Exactly. It's a concern. It's a political concern, but everything is bogged down in politics right now, including immigration and, you know.
Okay, Matt, from this dysfunctional House of Representatives that we've had so far, how did they get this passed? How is Mike Johnson actually, I mean, has he figured out the secret sauce of being effective in the House of Representatives? How did he get all the Republicans? How did he get that vote?
Yes, he has been extremely effective as speaker so far. I think there was a lot of concern. He was so novice that he wouldn't be able to figure out how to wrangle the Freedom Caucus. But the difference between him and the prior speaker is that he has been very firm and direct with the biggest naysayers within his conference. Because of his own conservative credentials, he gets more leeway with the House Freedom Caucus guys who have been such a thorn in the side to Kevin McCarthy. So he is behind closed doors. He has been very firm, taken the time to explain the realities of the politics of shutdowns or how they need a big bill like this to get the business community behind the Republicans going into the November elections. He's been a master negotiator for example, on this tax bill with key members of the Democrat Senate caucus to put this package together. And that's why they got such a big majority last night, especially when we all think that bipartisanship is dead. He's also had to, because of the House Freedom Caucus membership on the Rules Committee, had to bypass the Rules Committee, which he only has so many chances to do before he runs.
Wait a minute. Why would he have to bypass the Rules Committee? I know I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but so if you have a bill, you've got to run it through Rules Committee before you bring it to the floor. But there's a way not to take it through Rules Committee and still bring it to the floor.
If you know you have 2/3 of the votes in the House of Representatives, you can bypass the Rules Committee. Otherwise, if you have a tighter, more partisan piece of legislation, you take it to the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee sets the parameters and how the bill is debated on the floor. But as of late, the Freedom Caucus folks have, out of protest, have been voting down the rules. therefore you can't bring these more partisan bills to the floor.
There are a lot of Freedom Caucus people on the Rules Committee, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, the way
that's the bottleneck.
That's the bottleneck, exactly. And that the way that Kevin McCarthy was able to help get the speakership is that he placed the Freedom Caucus guys on key committees such as Rules and Appropriations.
You know, Les Munson pointed out, as we've talked about Mike Johnson versus Kevin McCarthy before, that Kevin McCarthy had been there so long that there was some real scorched earth, some really damaged relationships. Then there was no way back, meaning that these people were just going to be perpetually pissed at McCarthy and say no to whatever he suggested.
That's exactly
no what. And that Johnson doesn't have that same negative history, and it allows him basically to take the same approach and get things done about which McCarthy would have been totally thwarted. And you know something, anybody who's kind of been through high school understands how that can happen. Yeah, he took that girl away from me or got between me and her, and I don't care what that guy wants. I'm never going to vote for him. Has nothing to do with the merit of his bill. He pissed me off, and that's that. So, we people understand these sort of basic emotional things. Now, what I don't understand is if Johnson got around it, you're saying that if he keeps it up, there could be more pressure for one of those votes to vacate?
Yes, exactly. I mean, the Freedom Caucus members wanted to be on Rules because they wanted the power, and now he's bypassing their power. And so now there's this growing chorus of complaints against the speaker by bypassing Rules. So the speaker has only so many bites at the apple. And I think he's only going to use he's only going to be able to bypass the Rules Committee so many times, or else I do think there could be an eventual risk to his speakership.
You know, it strikes me like as the lawmakers that go ahead and pass loopholes in the income tax and then get pissed off when people go ahead and sign up and say, okay, if I don't have to pay that, or I get a credit for my mortgage, well, you're too rich. You shouldn't be taking a credit for your mortgage. Well, right. You didn't write that. So tough Shinskys, right. You know, I mean, serious exactly. Stuff. Okay. So get it's mad true. About, but they can tantrum and go after Johnson. Okay. Let me move on to the Senate here. And then I'm going to move on, ladies and gentlemen, I promise. I don't want to get too far, and I'm already too far in the weeds. I should start. All right. But why wouldn't a Democratic Senate glom on to this particular bill with the Biden bucks coming in November on the spend of this tax credit? And it's a tax credit like refund thing, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
They're just going to send out money. You never paid the taxes, but you're going to get a check. It's a great way to just say we're going to have a new spending bill. So why wouldn't the Democratic majority Senate just say great and pass it immediately?
Because the Senate has a different rule structure, and the Senate clearly has a different, you know, is very ideologically divided from the House at the moment. This has been the most House versus Senate Congress that I've ever seen, and less about party unity. So therefore, that the Senate has to achieve a 60-vote cloture threshold with any one senator being able to bog down the process. Without that 60-vote threshold, you can't move forward with a piece of legislation. So that is a completely different hurdle that the Senate has to meet versus the House. Now we're in. So you have the top Senate, you have the top Republican on Senate Finance, which has jurisdiction over the tax legislation, crying foul over the Biden bucks. Therefore, he has the power to slow install the legislation when the Senate already has a really long to-do list, such as Ukraine border supplemental and two massive appropriations packages that need to be passed by March 8th.
So this doesn't look like it's going to get through the Senate.
Not anytime soon. I do think that given the huge bipartisan margin in the House, it will eventually put a lot of pressure on the Senate to do something on this bill. Whether they win or fail, they'll have to demonstrate action.
They can't. I mean, procedurally, do they go through and sort of after they say we're not going to pass it, do they offer sort of red line suggestions back to the House?
That's always a possibility. Yes, they could, but then they'd have to go back to the House for another vote.
Okay. There was a spending agreement. I don't want to say a spending bill. There was a spending agreement in the EU countries that we found out about. $50 billion for Ukraine coming from the European countries, to which I say, hallelujah, brother. It's about damn time you people get on with paying some of these bills, because there's nothing in this most recent tax bill for Ukraine or Israel, is there?
No, there's not.
So we still have a stop basically on additional spending to support those poor people. And I'm all for supporting Ukraine in this, but I really have been a little chagrined that it didn't seem like the European countries, who happen to have a little bit closer interests than ours, hadn't stepped up. So $50 billion, how much time does that buy the Ukrainians?
$50 billion, I mean, it allows them to maintain their offensive campaign. And it could, this, you know, could last them well into December, is my understanding. So this does
release December.
Yep,
it's a whole year of funding.
Potentially, yes. It depends. Oh, that's largely based on strategic decisions by Zelensky. But this $50 billion could help sustain their offensive campaign, which they seem to be getting more and more aggressive with, going further and further into the Russian interior.
Well, we you know, certainly hope and pray for our Ukrainian friends over there, who have been victims, have been complete victims, I think. Just absolutely awful. Is Russia in trouble at all? I mean, they seem to just keep going on, and like the money doesn't matter and the hundreds of thousands of lives don't matter, and nobody holds Putin accountable. And don't they run out of economic rope at some point, or don't they run out of military rope? I mean, they were getting 50-year-old men out of prisons. Folks, I'm older than that, but I mean, and I'm fair. For my age, I'm very fit, but you don't want to put me on the front lines, folks.
Wait, how many pushups can you do a day, though? How many pushups a day?
100 pushups a day. I do pushups a day. But I mean, you don't want to put me up against a 23-year-old. Unless you give me, I am a pretty good shot. I am a pretty good shot. I've been doing that all my life.
So, I've seen you. It's
right?
pretty good.
you don't want, I mean, 50-year-olds fighting 50-year-olds. I think, you know, we'll fight for a little while and then we want to head to the golf course. Really, it just happens in time. If you're not this old, I promise it happens. So, Matt, Putin, what's...
I mean, Putin, Putin, I think, is being sustained by, you know, high energy prices, and they are able to just cling on with oil. And that seems to be the only thing that's keeping them alive at the moment. I mean, after sanctions and isolation, and they always seem to like move forward. But like the Cold War, all that smoke and mirrors eventually clears, and I don't see how this could be sustained.
I don't know how the other power in Russia continues to put up with this. Things are heading in one direction. It's not a good direction. And I don't care how he circles his troops, but he needs them. Matt Leffingwell's a partner at Tiber Creek, a Washington lobbyist firm. If you need to get it done in D.C., you call Matt. Hey, thank you so much for being
here. It's great to be with you, Michael, as always.
It's wonderful. We're going to be right back with Daryl Owen, folks. You want to hear that Louisiana drawl just one more time and understand about oil? Well, he's going to tell us about oil and why it's important in the Middle East as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world here on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr.
Thank you.
We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. Glad you're with us again. Here we go, February. We're moving forward with this year, whether you like it or not, folks. The calendar says we must. As we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, and all of the economic and market implications that we can think about anyway, bringing you insiders to help us figure it out. Joining us now, Daryl Owen. Now, Daryl Owen is one of my greatest, oldest buddies, nationally recognized expert in energy policy. He's a Washington lobbyist. He was chief of staff for Senator Bennett Johnson from Louisiana. And other than that strong Boston accent that Daryl has, you can tell he's from Louisiana, and he knows all about oil and everything else in D.C. Welcome back, Daryl.
Always a pleasure to be here, Michael. Thank you.
We are very glad you're here. Daryl, we've talked a lot with Matt Levingwell about what's been going on in Washington, and it has an appearance of functionality that it didn't have, with Kevin McCarthy, that it now has with Mike Johnson. But it doesn't still seem like they're getting much done. Am I wrong about that?
Well, they're keeping the government functional, which is sort of at best break even. And patting themselves on the back over that. So in that respect, you're correct. It's the appearance of progress without meaningful progress.
Well, they got a continuing, resolution to keep spending. And Chuck Schumer came out and said, we've saved the American, we've saved ourselves from a crisis, and we've saved America from a crisis by coming together on the... They created the crisis. It's their own stupid spending bill. They have their own stupid deadlines, their own stupid continuing resolution. Anyway, I think the MOS, as we say in the media business, man on the street, is probably getting wise to this game. Though they're not wise to a lot, as they seem to be intent on choosing Donald Trump and Joe Biden as the two best candidates for the next president of the United States. Is this really going to be it? I mean, we're hearing this guy Kennedy might now run as a libertarian. Wow. And Nikki Haley might stay in the race for a no labels or some other third party, fourth party candidate. Does any of this play out? Is Joe Biden going to be the next president of the United States? Is Donald Trump going to be the next president of the United States? What do you think?
Well, how much time you got? What you're seeing is the rebound effect of the Electoral College. It is all but impossible for a third party candidate to win the presidency, because most states still award their electoral votes on a winner take all basis. So you know the Democrats are going to get all the electoral votes in California, in Oregon, in Washington State, in Massachusetts, in New York. The Republicans are going to get all the electoral votes from Texas and Florida and the Southeast and the Southwest. And there's no proportionality there for a third party candidate to come in and capture enough electoral college votes to contend. So the two-party system has sort of metastasized, which is how you bring nominees to the fore like Donald Trump and Joe Biden, of whom everyone is thoroughly sick, or at least most are thoroughly sick. And I don't see any realistic opening for Kennedy or...
Yeah, but could they come in just as a spoiler? I mean, if Kennedy comes in, does Joe Biden lose?
Ross Perot did it. Ralph Nader. Yeah, it is entirely possible that that could happen. And you have to think that Democrats are trying to slap some sense into Kennedy to say that all you can do is bring us another 4 years of Donald Trump. I don't think take seriously the notion that Haley would run as a third party candidate. I think she's too smart. I think she's doing this because she is ingratiating herself with what used to be the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And sort of taunting Trump, which is.
I think if Kennedy runs, as third party candidate, the Democrats should fund a Nikki Haley campaign. So at least there's a counterbalance to suck away those other extra votes. Anyway, all right. So Joe Biden next president by the time all of this shakes through, or Trump?
If I had to bet a mortgage payment, I would probably bet on Biden, because no one has really started taking a clean shot at Trump yet. Haley flirts with it on occasion. None of the rest of the primary candidates did it. And people have blissfully forgotten what life was like under this man for 4 years. Yeah. And his behavior and some of his rhetoric in this campaign is so offensive and so off-putting, and so reminiscent of bad history, bad global history, that I think he's going to erode what little support he has among moderates, among suburban women, even among Wall Street.
And all of that, but his base, there is nothing overly offensive for his base. I am talking to people. I talked to people in Washington last weekend. I've been talking to people here in Florida who are still devout Trump supporters. I talked to a guy yesterday from Iowa, runs a large company. He caucuses in Iowa. And he said, of course, you've got to have Donald Trump as president. Completely there. By the way, talk to this guy. You know, it's so hard to meet someone from Iowa. For years, I really didn't think there were people in Iowa. I just didn't. I never met anybody from Iowa. And this fella tells me he married a woman from North Dakota, another place where I've suspected there are not many people. Well, there are not many people in North Dakota. But I thought, well, dear God, what? I looked at him. I said, what do you two talk about? I mean, do you, when you sit home and play Parcheesi at night under your Afghans across your knees and drink your lemonade, what do you talk about? And he looks up, he goes, oh, you know, planes landing at the new airport, you know, the corn futures, just what you think we talk about. He was a very funny
guy. You wonder why these people love basketball.
Oh, he'd love anything, anything. I'm going to say something.
I mean, your point is valid about the Trump base, Michael, but it's roughly half of the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is either a distant second or third in terms of party registration throughout the country. The largest registration now is independent. And are those people committed? Absolutely. The shoot somebody in the middle of Madison Avenue, they wouldn't faze them. They're a minority segment of the overall electorate. And what Trump is doing is turning away, in my estimation, that central segment, which is ultimately going to be necessary for him to prevail. The thing that keeps Trump viable is his support in the swing states. And Biden's eroding support in the swing states, particularly of Michigan, where you've got such a Middle Eastern and Muslim voting base. And those folks appear to be turning away from him in great numbers because of what's going on in Israel. And he can't afford to lose many of those swing states to Trump and still prevail in the Electoral College. He will romp in the popular vote, Biden will. But he could still, as he once did before, or as Hillary did before, he could lose the Electoral College by losing those swing states.
And helping and showing up for the unions isn't enough in Michigan for him?
It was certainly helpful. But, you know, so many of those guys will, as they say about Republicans in the House, they'll vote no and take the dough. They will take the dough and still vote for Trump. It is amazing the political realignment that has happened in the last dozen years with working class people in this country. And while their union leadership supports Biden for good reason, it's not entirely clear to me that brings along the rank and file.
Let's move to Israel, Palestine, Gaza, Middle East, and Iran. What happens there? You know, I've been talking to friends here in the 1970s when you and I were in our salad days and not thinking a lot about When in the 1970s, Daryl and I were thinking a lot along the same lines, but mostly involved girls and occasionally sports. But there were headlines about Jimmy Carter and about the Iranian hostage crisis and the Ayatollah Khomeini. And Iran has been nothing but antagonistic and an opposer, a violent opposer of the United States all of our lives, Daryl, and we haven't struck back. Will we do it this time?
Well, I think it's going to be more than a symbolic sense, but it's not going to be a dramatic strike back. In the wake of 9/11, the Iranians reached out to the United States and offered to assist us, and President Bush promptly declared them an axis of evil. We made progress with the Iranians under Obama with the nuclear agreement. I've been in nuclear facilities that are under seal, and I can tell you it is an incredibly intrusive regime, and nothing sneaks by anybody. Everything is wired shut. There are cameras, there are human observers. It's an amazingly thorough system. And we under President
Trump. I'm not sure I understand which way. When you say it's very thorough, to protect what the Iranians are doing, to protect
Stop the Iranians from cheating.
To stop the Iranians from cheating.
Right.
You think that are we doing that effectively?
We were, and yes. It's much more difficult to do it now because Trump pulled out of the nuclear agreement that we had with Iran. So we have done pretty much everything we can to slap the Iranians in the face every time they have shown any willingness to cooperate with us. And I think we're seeing the offshoots of that now through a lot of these militias. Would that have happened without that? Quite possibly.
I want to ask a question, Daryl, that I hope doesn't offend you or seem rude. When I hear that Trump pulled out of that agreement, which Trump pulled us out of that agreement, and that's the problem, I always wonder how partisan your attitude is. Is that a Democratic attitude? Is that when you try to, I guess, get away from each party's rhetoric and as an independent myself to try and figure out, okay, what are the real facts here? How do I get at the real truth going on? Is there any on self-reflection? Is there any party bias in your comments?
I'd like to think, Michael, that it's more based on the fact that in my 12 years in the Senate, I was deeply involved with the nuclear weapons program, and I understand it from the inside in a way that few people have the ability to do, and I can appreciate what the Iranians were doing, what threat it represented, and what an incredible accomplishment it was for, remember, this was not just the US, this was China, this was Russia, this was the EU, this was Germany, to bring the Iranians to heel, to put them into a circumstance where they were downscaling their nuclear efforts. they were deactivating reactors, they were de-enriching fuel, they had safeguards put in place by the International Atomic Energy Agency. It was a remarkable accomplishment and a very positive one. And to have pulled out of that was a monumental mistake in my estimation. And I say that based on what I know to be the realistic threats.
I think, ladies and gentlemen, as we bring you insights, everybody has opinions. And what I want to point out here is Daryl has opinions. There's no question that Daryl has opinions, but he just qualified firsthand knowledge here. You hear a lot of people talk about what's going on in Iran. You haven't talked to many people who have been there, who have seen it, who were part of it on Capitol Hill and who followed through. Worth, at least for me, to clarify and get to that. We try and bring you, we want to bring you truth, and you decide, really, you need to decide. Daryl, I can't believe it, but we're already out of time, and there's so much more I want to ask you. Tell me how you see a response on Iran. We're going to run over here, Harry. What sort of response? Will it be anything decisive? And will we see Israel still fighting in Palestine and going after Hamas this time next year? Does this just drag on and on, or how does this get resolved?
Let me answer those in reverse. I can't concede that the Israelis are going to be able to continue to resist the pressure to stand down in Gaza. The agreement that looks like it is all but finalized for suspension of hostilities and an exchange of hostages appears to be embraced by virtually everyone other than Israel. And I don't think Israel can continue to adopt that posture. They've already lost tremendous, tremendous support worldwide, and they can't continue to do that. And the United States cannot afford to be a part of that support if they're going to continue to resist. In terms of Iran, they've sent signals. We did not order this strike. And you've seen the people who conducted the strike saying, we're not going to do this again. There's an effort underway to de-escalate from the Iranian side of the equation. Is it sincere? Hard to tell, but I think we have to assume that it is at least somewhat sincere. We're going to exact a toll on these guys. It's going to be broad-based. It's going to be extended. It's not going to be a one-and-done situation. That will sort of even the score from the U.S. standpoint and hopefully create a situation where all sides can de-escalate.
I can't imagine whatever sort of action occurs that President Biden will get it right, meaning he's going to get criticized no matter what. I don't mean that he can't get it right. Of course, the president can get it right. And my point here is the president can get it perfectly right, and he's going to get criticized that he got it wrong, that he did too much, that he didn't do enough, that he went too far, that he didn't go far enough, that he was too weak, that he's too old. You know, one of my favorites, Daryl, down here, I hate bumper sticker politics. The people who practice, you know, bumper sticker politics and tell me that they hate Joe Biden. And I'll say, OK, tell me the three things he's done, the policy things that you really object to, because I like to learn about politics. And they look at me kind of blank and say, well, you know, he's just too damned old. OK. And I'll do the same thing when people tell me they hate Trump. Really? Tell me the three things. Can you tell me one thing President Trump did that you like? Because I can. You know, there's a whole hell of a lot that I didn't like about President Trump, and I still don't like. But I can tell you a couple of good things the guy did. And I can tell you a couple of good things Joe Biden did, and a couple of bad things Joe Biden did, and a couple of bad things Trump did. I mean, how do you not have a balanced view in politics and be informed? But if you're not informed and you just want to spout your opinion off, I don't have time for you. It just irritates
me. I couldn't agree more, Michael, and I was struck by the fact that when the Iranian militias struck the U.S. base in Jordan, that the outcry from the Republicans was not fury at the Iranians or their proxies. It was at Joe Biden. And it makes your point that there's no way for him to win in this circumstance. Whatever he does, he will be criticized. So he might as well do what he believes to be the right thing.
You know, I've said for years, the one thing we all ought to do as Republicans and Democrats and independents is say a prayer every day for the president of the United States. No matter who that person is, everybody, it's in everybody's interest that that person is the most successful president our country's ever had. I don't know why people don't get it, Daryl. So you think things will slow down and that that there will be we won't be going on in Israel a year from now. And if you had to pick a president in the fall, you think Joe Biden, eh?
If you had to.
Well, we're going to find out, and we're going to have you back with us because we always learn so much. Daryl Owen, nationally recognized energy policy expert, Chief of Staff Senator Johnson, has the great firm of Owen, Evans, and Ingalls. If you want to get it done in D.C., you call D.O. Daryl Owen, my man. Thank you, Daryl.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
That's it for another Farcast, ladies and gentlemen, as we have covered Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Hope you've learned as much as I have on this Farcast. We'll be back again next week and do it all over again. Try and figure it out. Watch these markets. Watch that 10-year Treasury. The Fed will start to make noise next week. I have a speech coming up, and there's still places available. University of Delaware, I'm going to be speaking with Fed President Pat Harker to give our economic forecast again this coming year. Harry will have details and tell you how we can get H. Jennings, at farmiller.com, hjennings@farmiller.com. Harry, I'll tell you how you can come in person and you get a chance to meet the Fed president. You get a chance to meet me too, but I assure you there's no real great treat in that. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Please share us on your social media. Bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Farcast. Michael will be traveling in the coming weeks, but we are planning on continuing our weekly episodes through the winter and into spring as we continue Season 7. Michael will be appearing at the University of Delaware's annual economic forecast alongside President of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank, Patrick Harker, on February 22nd. If you would like to attend, you can search for Lerner Business School Economic Forecast or just email me at hjennings@farmiller.com. I'll be happy to send you information on how you can reserve your tickets and see Michael, President Harker, and others share their insights into the evolving economic situation. Thanks to our guests this week, Jim Urio, Matt Leffingwell, and Daryl Owen. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms. You can stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new one. Please be aware that any time we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, news headline, or economic trend, it's not a recommendation to buy or sell. Please review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. And as always, if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'm happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability for any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.